Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke, and here's one of the big questions we're asking today. Are you willing to pay for more light rail and buses? Because the Sound Transit 3 measure is on your fall ballot. It's called Proposition 1. It's a $54 billion package with the money coming from a sales tax and a car tax and property taxes. Those taxes and the construction would last at least 25 years. Urging you to vote yes is Shefali Ranganathan of the Transportation Choices Coalition. She calls this a once-in-a-generation opportunity to connect our region with rail, Everett to Kirkland to Tacoma. I talked with her and an opponent of Sound Transit 3. Maggie Fimia of the Puget Sound Regional Council says this big project would not solve congestion.
The implication that this is going to help people with traffic or get you out of traffic is patently false. It has no effect on traffic.
How can that be that it doesn't affect traffic?
Right. The reason is so few new people are getting onto it. The plan for the last 20 years and the next 30 to 40 is we move people off of buses on to rail. And light rail was never meant to go out into the suburbs. It was meant for very high, dense urban cores. I've got the numbers from Sound Transit. They finally told us how many new riders, and actually they didn't tell us new riders, they told us new trips by new riders. So if you can imagine, between now and 2040, according to Puget Sound Regional Council, which is the planning agency, we're going to be taking about 4 million more trips in this region a day. It'll be up to 19 million trips a day just in this four-county region. Sound Transit, even with 100 miles plus of light rail, will only attract about 64,000 new trips. That's after decades and decades and billions of dollars. Mostly it's people moved from the buses onto the trains, and there's no plan to help those people that are in buses stuck in traffic.
Do you accept those numbers?
Those numbers are cherry-picking the facts. Right now, into downtown Seattle, the Central Business District, 45% of commuters are on transit. That's today. When U-Link opened to Capitol Hill and to the Husky Stadium, boardings grew by 28,000. 15,000 of those 28,000 were new trips, new boardings. These are people who hadn't been on transit before.
Maggie, the new UW and Capitol Hill light rail lines seem to be going gangbusters.
Yeah, because they've Mr. Constantine, who's in charge of Metro and of Sound Transit, rerouted dozens of bus routes to feed the train. That's the plan. That's always been the plan, and that's the plan in the future, is existing bus riders. Yep, you have high ridership when there's games, but those aren't commuters. Sound Transit had promised about 103,000 riders by now with that segment, and they're getting all excited because they're doing that once or twice, but it was supposed to be an average by now.
Shefali, are we just moving people off of buses who are already using public transit?
Look, some of those transit riders are bus riders, but what is not part of this conversation is the fact that bus service got better. More neighborhoods are connected with more frequent bus service, better service, and that's the plan for transit agencies all across the region. When light rail opens to Linwood, community transit absolutely plans up in Snohomish County to be able to do east-west so that you can feed into light rail. I talked about capacity of light rail. It is efficient to move those people, and people are voting with their feet. 101,000 boardings a few weeks ago. And yes, some of them were Husky game goers, but let's be real. What people are making is they're making a choice not to be stuck in traffic. So that's why they're getting on rail, because it's 4 minutes to downtown, 8 minutes from Husky Stadium to downtown.
You want to respond?
Again, this does nothing for traffic, and they admit that. So if people think that this investment is going to be reducing traffic, just like we thought last 20 years, it's incorrect. We get calls and letters from folks who have lost their bus service or it has been rerouted so that they can't make those connections easily. Older people, disabled people, it's fine if you're a young person with a backpack. It might work really well for you. But a lot of people are losing their service. The whole system needs to rise, not just winners and losers. And that's what's happening in the region.
Maggie, what about greenhouse gas emissions reduced because of fewer cars?
That is a huge misrepresentation of the facts. They are counting both ST1 and ST2, which brings, I think, about 60 miles of light rail.
These are the earlier parts of the Sound Transit project.
Yes, that we've already approved. They're counting those. Plus, they're not counting the enormous amount of greenhouse emissions that happen by building these systems. So your net benefit isn't out for decades and decades and decades with greenhouse gas emissions. That's just, there's a very good blog on the Washington Policy Center just this week about how it's about $100 we'd paying to get about, I think, 11 cents of reduction.
Shefali, I take it you dispute those numbers.
I mean, you're quoting the Washington Policy Center. They are a known conservative blog that I think may be climate change deniers. Look, it is simple. Transportation is the single largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in our region. And unless we find ways to give people options to not drive by themselves, we are going to be stuck in this cycle for decades to come. And a light rail is clean, electric light rail, and it will move 16,000. It has a capacity to move 16,000 people an hour in each direction.
What is your vision for more and better service instead of Sound Transit?
So it was
three.
When we decided not to do rail here in the late 60s and early 70s, we turned down heavy rail. And folks need to look up the difference between heavy rail and light rail.
What's the difference?
Heavy rail is the systems that I grew up with in New York, or used in Chicago, or BART, totally separated from traffic, many, many cars, so can carry thousands of people, and it is fast. Light rail can be no more than four cars long, and parts of it have to share the right-of-way with cars in intersections. So you can configure a bus system, as cities all over the world have done. You get the best aspects of rail, and you use it for your bus. So dedicated lanes or almost dedicated lanes, like up in community transit with the Swift bus, it's a bus-only lane. Prepay, bus pulls up, all the doors open, people deboard and get on very, very quickly within 11 seconds. So again, like a rail. And comfortable seats. This light rail, when they're at capacity and overcapacity, most people will be standing and will not be comfortable. And the express bus is going to go away. It's kind of the dirty little secret of this plan. If you're going from Everett to downtown now for work and back on express bus, that's one stop. The light rail has to stop at every station, 15 to 16 stops. So when we decided not to do rail, we decided to do high-capacity bus system here. And we committed to 310 miles of HOV. And the bus tunnel. And consequently, we have some of the highest transit ridership in the country, and we're letting that degrade. Why is that?
That's Maggie Femia's description of the Sound Transit 3 we're about to decide on. What's your vision of it, Shefali?
Look, I'm a bus rider. I've been a bus rider for decades, and I'm a transit supporter. And there is a role for buses. And Sound Transit 3 has investments in two bus rapid transit lines on 405 and on 522. There is a role for bus rapid transit. But the vision that Maggie just described requires you doing dedicated right-of-way. So that means, picture this, taking away an entire freeway lane for buses not to be stuck in traffic like everything else. She mentioned Everett. The average time that it takes for you to get from Everett to Seattle on time is 76 minutes. That's today. Our HOV lane system is failing. And unless we are willing to give up lanes to make this bus rapid transit system work, it's not going to work out. And, you know, we talked about capacity. To move those 16,000 people that I talked about, you need 175 buses. One light rail train moves that in one direction. And so we're talking about the scale of investment to make bus rapid transit truly shine. You will need the scale of investment that you're looking at with rail.
You've been listening to Shefali Ranganathan, who's executive director of the Transportation Choices Coalition, telling you why you should vote yes on Sound Transit 3. That's Proposition 1 on your ballot. And you also heard from Puget Sound Regional Council Transportation Policy Board member Maggie Femia, a part of the No on ST3 campaign. Hope we've helped. Happy voting. This is KUOW's The Record. Perseverance, building bridges, and not gloating. State Senator Pramila Jayapal and State Representative Brady Walkinshaw say those are the lessons they learned working across party lines in the Washington State Legislature. Now those two are competing to represent Seattle in the other Washington, and they say the lessons they learned could serve them well in a hyper-partisan Congress. Here's KUOW reporter Amy Radel.
Brady Walkinshaw says dozens of professions exclude people with criminal convictions. And of the 8,000 people released from prison each year in Washington, 42% go back within 1 year. Those statistics motivated him to work with Republicans to open up more fields to released felons.
And what it does is it brings down the occupational barriers, the licensing barriers for people to find employment after prison.
Walkinshaw worked with State Senator Mike Padden, a conservative from Eastern Washington, to craft the legislation.
And I will say, the first year we introduced it, it didn't get very far. But after, you know, 3 years of perseverance, we were able to find a compromise that is now being implemented across Washington State.
One area of compromise was how eligibility would work for different crimes. The law does not apply to sex offenders, for example. Walkinshaw also worked with Republicans to pass Joel's Law, named for Joel Reuter, who was shot by police after his family's requests for help with his mental illness were denied. It gives families the ability to petition a judge if their relative is denied hospitalization while in crisis. Speaking at his campaign headquarters in Wallingford, Walkinshaw says these laws show his ability to work across party lines and build relationships.
We need to elect leaders who don't accentuate the partisanship in our country, but who are able to bring us together. And that is why the vast majority of colleagues that work with both of us in the Washington State Legislature have endorsed me. It's why the majority of the Seattle City Council has endorsed me in this race.
It's been difficult for voters to draw many distinctions between the two candidates because they embrace many of the same values and positions. On a recent weekday morning, both Walkinshaw and Jayapal campaigned before members of a men's civic organization based at Seattle's First AME Church. Walkinshaw noted that the crowd has a choice between two great progressives for their congressional representative. Retired attorney Lem Howell said he's concerned about the lack of prosecutions around police shootings, starting with the case of John T. Williams in Seattle in 2010.
When John Williams, who was a little wood carver who was intoxicated, was walking down the street with his little penknife, and an officer just came and said, drop the knife, and she bang, 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 shot him. We're told by the prosecutor there's absolutely nothing he could do because the state law requires malice
in order to convict a police officer of wrongdoing. Walkinshaw says that malice requirement makes Washington State an outlier nationwide. Both he and Jayapal sponsored legislation to remove that language, but it didn't pass. Jayapal told the group their best hope is through a ballot initiative.
It's tough. There's not a lot of money in that initiative right now, but I would really urge everybody in this room to help to do what's possible to move that initiative forward.
She also touched on some of her proudest achievements as a state senator, like legislation to train people for ironworking and other types of construction jobs.
I am proud that even in a Republican-controlled legislature, I have been able to pass legislation that invested millions of dollars into pre-apprenticeship programs, specifically for people of color and women to get jobs in the transportation sector. Those are the kinds of jobs that we are finally going to get our folks into.
Back at her campaign office on Western Avenue downtown, Jayapal says she had to win over lawmakers opposed to targeting apprenticeships to specific groups.
I don't believe that you get trickle-down equality. I think you actually have to target resources at specific populations, low-income populations, people of color, women, in order sometimes to get the benefits to really accrue to those folks.
Another bill she's proud of, improving Medicaid reimbursement for women's long-term contraception. In that case, the Republicans she worked with were leery of getting into reproductive issues. She says ultimately they supported it on the condition that she not loudly declare victory.
The big compromise was don't talk about it too much and don't make it a big issue on the floor.
With so many issues in common, Walkinshaw has tried to distinguish himself as the truly local candidate. He's criticized Jayapal for the money she's received from outside Washington state, partly through fundraising appeals from former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. Jayapal responds that her average contribution is $25, and she says she does envision a role in Congress that goes beyond the 7th District.
United States Congress is a national role. You make policy for the country. A local politician would be the city council.
Walkinshaw lives on Capitol Hill. He's noted that Jayapal does not live in the 7th Congressional District. Jayapal says her Columbia City home was in the district until the lines were last drawn when it was placed in the 9th. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
And speaking of elections, have you heard that we almost had a Seattleite a heartbeat away from the presidency? That's one of the revelations from the Clinton campaign's emails released by WikiLeaks. On the short list for her VP nominees, Bill Gates, Melinda Gates, and Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. What other local would have made a good vice president? Jeff Bezos? Chris Gregoire? Sue Bird? Richard Sherman? Macklemore? Sir Mix-a-Lot, perhaps. Nancy Pearl, send us your answer on Twitter at KUOW. And we're going to hear from Vice President Nancy Pearl in about a half an hour. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you've tuned in today. It was just a couple of years ago that Jenny Henderson learned the full story of her grandfather's death. His name was Fred Goree. He was her mom's dad, and he was manager of a Negro League baseball team. And one night in 1925, he and some team members were driving through Ferguson, Missouri, in his new Buick.
And he was pulled over by the police for speeding. He commented to the officer that he wasn't speeding because the traffic wouldn't allow that. And he was pulled out of his car. He was accused of driving a stolen vehicle. And reportedly, he and the officer had some words. He was accused of being an uppity N-word, and I think it came to blows. Somehow they ended up in the ditch. And the police officer pulled out his baton and beat my grandfather severely in his head and probably other areas of his body as well until he was passed out in the ditch. The officer called to one of the other officers to hold the other team members at bay in the car, and that officer pulled his gun and pointed it at the other team members so that they couldn't come to Fred's rescue. And then the one officer announced that he was going to finish off my grandfather, and he shot him and left him in the ditch. And to my understanding, he then took the car and drove around on a joyride after that.
Today, Jenny is a licensed mental health counselor here in Seattle, and she told Jeannie Yandel how her grandfather's murder has reverberated through her family, starting with her own mom, who never really talked about what happened.
My mom may have mentioned it on just a handful of occasions, but when she told us about what happened to her dad, she didn't really show emotion about it. It was just a matter-of-fact comment in passing. And as a child, I didn't understand the gravity of what had happened to her. And really, to be honest, I was too self-absorbed to spend much time thinking about it. So I knew this had happened. But partly because of my own attitude and being self-absorbed, and also because of the way my mom told the story, just in bits and pieces without feeling behind it, I didn't really spend too much time on it. I didn't have any understanding of what that meant for her and what it meant for her family and how it impacted the way she parented and the way she was with us as a family.
Well, now you do know what happened to your mom's family after your grandfather was killed.
Fred Goree was the oldest of 13 children. He was a breadwinner for the family. He was stability for the family, and many, many relatives leaned on him. So when he was murdered, the family then spiraled into severe poverty. It was the Depression, and he'd been earning a good living, not only as a manager of that baseball team, but also as a bricklayer. And so without that income, the family was devastated financially and emotionally.
Well, Jenny, you also said that learning about your grandfather helped you better understand your mom. It helped you better understand her as a parent. What did you mean by that?
My mom had a lot of challenges in many of her relationships. We saw her vacillate from being very warm at times with some distant relationships or with strangers. But within the family, there was a consistent lack of emotion there that was demonstrated to my dad, that was demonstrated to us. And we didn't really understand why my mom was as cold as she was. But now that I have the insight and the knowledge of the story of Fred and what happened to him and the impact on the family, I understand that in order to protect herself and to protect her heart, she really had to remain detached. She could not let herself feel too deeply because of the pain that she'd experienced and that severe loss.
Have you had conversations with your mom about this?
No, definitely not. My mom passed away about 11 years ago. And I don't really know that it was a conversation we could have had. It certainly wasn't one that was comfortable for me. And to be honest, I don't know that she would have been able to open up and share her true feelings with me either. And I won't have an opportunity to find out, unfortunately.
I'm talking with Jenny Henderson. She's a licensed mental health counselor here in Seattle. She moved here from the Midwest a few years ago. And Jenny, I'm wondering where you think your grandfather's death shows up in your life now. You talked about understanding how it showed up for your mom as an adult. Where do you think it shows up for you?
It gives me an even deeper sense of understanding and compassion for those who have lost loved ones in similar circumstances. And it helps me to understand the need for showing compassion and love consistently to my son. I shower him with those qualities that I didn't receive as a child. And some of that understanding even goes beyond words. It's just on an emotional level that I feel I more completely understand now.
Is there an image or an exchange with your son that springs to mind when you talk about that?
I don't have a particular image in mind, but I do really try to be patient with him and allow him to express himself in the time he's comfortable with, instead of insisting that he talk about these issues at the moment I want him to. I seize those teaching moments that are brought up maybe as we watch the news or as we watch a movie together or whenever they spring up. And we talk about it then just in tiny little bits and pieces that he can try to digest. Anything more than that is clearly overwhelming to him. And I just allow him to have that space to take it in, to be supported, to be validated, and then to move on to something else.
You talked about teaching moments that you see when you're watching the news with your son, when you're watching movies with your son. What are the conversations that you and he have when you are watching the news and there is another story about a man of color being killed by police officers?
The conversations are very brief, because that's really all he's able to have at this time. And often the conversation is one-sided. It's me providing him with validation, with compassion, with sharing my concerns for his safety. But he often shuts down emotionally. And he's told me in other circumstances that he doesn't want me to worry about him, so he doesn't bring up certain things. And I think this might be one of those topics that he chooses to stay quiet about because he sees the emotion in me and the impact it has on me and how concerned I am for him and his safety. What I would like him to take away from the story of my grandfather is to know that it's very important for him to live his life, to make the choices he feels are right for him, and to do those things that he loves doing and is passionate about, regardless of what's happening in the world. I want him to know that he comes from greatness and that he has a reason, many, many reasons, to be proud of who and what he is, and that he can't live his life in fear because that will only hold him back.
Since this is something you do in your work, you look at how trauma affects people, the mental health impacts of trauma. What do you think we're missing when it comes to the impact of men of color being killed by police? As you and I talked about earlier, the way the media covers it is in this very, this just happened, and then everybody appears to move on.
Right.
What are we missing when we talk about these shootings in that sort of immediate way?
I think not everybody understands the depth of the pain that we hold inside and the impact of that trauma, whether it's a family member, a neighbor, or somebody we see on the news. It's a very personal thing because it impacts how we see ourselves, how other people see us, and the human value within how we're perceived. We want to be perceived as valuable, as worthy, as capable, as good people, just like anybody else. But this type of trauma breaks us down in many ways. It breaks us down and makes us question ourselves and our self-worth. It breaks down other people's perceptions of who and what we are. And it's a pain that we carry around with us, and there's really no relief from it, even if we talk about it, even if we share it and address it and process it in therapy. There really is no relief because it's ongoing. And I may hear about some of the stories on the news, but I'm not hearing about all of it because there's just too much, too many. I can't remember the names. It's ongoing. We're constantly bombarded with this. And as soon as we think we've caught our breath, there's another news story and another news story. So it is incredibly impactful. This is something that ripples through the communities, through families, nationwide, worldwide, and the impact continues for years. We may not always understand the source of the impact, but we see it around us. We see it in the many traumatized people and the way they behave, how they do, the reactions they have to other people, the way they relate within their families, the way they parent, the way they work among their colleagues. The ripple effect is palpable, and it's constant, and it's ongoing, and there's very little chance to bounce back from it. And I'm not sure that everybody understands it on the level that African-American people and people of color understand it, because we feel it. We take it in. And it is very powerful and very painful in that way.
Jenny Henderson is now a licensed mental health counselor and a parent here in Seattle. Her grandfather, Fred Goree, was killed by a police officer in Missouri in 1925. She told the story to KUOW's Jeannie Yandel. Now on the record, we're going to keep talking about people in crisis, because every day in Seattle there's a crisis happening somewhere. It could be someone is acting erratically, threatening to hurt themselves or somebody else, and often the first responders to that are the police. KUOW's Ruby DeLuna says Seattle police are working on an app to help them reach out to people in crisis.
SPD's crisis response unit takes the bulk of the crisis calls, but there are only 4 officers and 1 mental health professional in that unit. Last year alone, there were more than 9,200 crisis incidents. The app would help patrol officers respond to these calls when the crisis response unit is tied up.
Give me 1 second here.
It's 11 in the morning. Officer Lewis Chan is scanning through the 911 calls that have come through waiting to be handled.
As you can see, there are a fair bunch.
How many are there right now?
Right now, I don't know.
A dozen?
No, I'd say closer to 30.
Chan looks for crisis calls. He's part of the crisis response unit.
Our ultimate main goal is to free up patrol officers so they can go to these 30-plus other 911 calls that aren't crisis related.
One call stands out. A patient with a history of attempted suicide didn't show up for an appointment. The case manager was concerned and called 911. Chan decides to check on the patient. As he drives, social worker Mariah Andrignes is on her phone. She's searching databases, including the Downtown Emergency Service Center, for any information about the patient.
So I have remote access to all of their notes. So like if it's one of our clients, I can go in and say, oh, look, Susie has had 3 run-ins with staff this week. Maybe we should call them and see what we have before we show up and talk.
Andrignes works with Chan. Part of their job is to connect people with services depending on the situation. Chan says in the past, people were sent to jail or to the hospital, which wasn't always the best long-term solution. Many ended up cycling through the system. We arrive at the patient's apartment building. Chan turns on his body cam. Another officer joins them per SPD policy. About 15 minutes later, they come out of the building. Andrignes says the patient's fine.
Today he's feeling much better. He's feeling safe. We gave him the information on how to get a hold of the crisis clinic, and he could talk to someone if he needed it. And he talked to his case manager just a few minutes ago, so he's feeling safe. He's feeling more stable now.
Back in the car, Chan explains how the app would help patrol officers. It would provide information and different response plans at their fingertips before they approach the person. It's like a field guide for patrol officers when the crisis response unit isn't able to take the call.
Hey, is this person a danger to anybody? What have they done in the past? When was their last interaction with the police? And kind of what tools or what tips or tricks can patrol officers use to better resolve whatever interaction they're having with. So it's kind of getting everybody on the same page.
The app would help in situations like the next call Chan takes. A man in old downtown Ballard is waving metal objects and causing a disturbance.
So this is an example of someone who's in more acute crisis where their behavior is potentially dangerous to the public or themselves.
A patrol officer responding would be able to use the app to get information about the man and a response plan. This applies to people who are familiar to the police, like this man.
We've been getting a bunch of reports about this person in the Ballard area who has been, lack of a better word, kind of terrorizing the neighborhood.
When we arrive at the scene, the man is wrapping his head with a t-shirt. Officer Chan gets out of the car and approaches him. Andrignes stays in the car as a safety precaution. 5 other officers arrive too. They stand back and keep an eye for safety issues. Chan talks to the man.
In a situation like this where there's a lot of unknowns, he could be kind of erratic. If you can be calm with a person, you stand a better chance of building a rapport, and that's what a lot of this is building rapport.
And help the person listen and calm down.
So I just kind of talked to him about himself, what his current condition was, what he might need. He was not willing to do anything. He didn't want to go anywhere. He's pretty set in sticking around this area and just doing his thing, whatever that might be. So it was really more of a strong encouragement to say, hey, your behavior is a little out of control now. Let's try and keep it in check. And then he left.
Soon after the man left, someone in the neighborhood told the police the man assaulted him last month. Chan plans to look for the police report and see if any more action needs to be taken.
Do you know what's causing this behavior?
We have a history on him. Like, obviously, I can't disclose it all, but, I mean, there's reasons for his behavior. It doesn't necessarily make it excusable. But we do know that he would benefit from getting help from medical and mental health providers.
Currently, more than 58% of officers have advanced training in crisis intervention. SPD says the app, scheduled for rollout later this month, would enhance their responses. I'm Ruby DeLuna, KUOW News.
This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke with a brief correction to an earlier segment. We were talking about Sound Transit 3 on the ballot, and you heard from Maggie Fimia, who is with People for Smarter Transit. No on ST3. She's a former member of the Puget Sound Regional Council Transportation Policy Board. Thanks for tuning in. The Record continues in a moment. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. You have heard Donald Trump say this presidential election is rigged, right? Rigged at the polling places, rigged by the dishonest media. What would you say to that, President Obama?
I'd advise Mr. Trump to stop whining and go try to make his case to get votes.
Obama says no serious person would suggest that it's even possible to rig an American election, and Mr. Trump should buck up.
You start whining before the game's even over? If whenever things are going badly for you and you lose, you start blaming somebody else, then you don't have what it takes to be in this job.
Now, American elections are not federally run. They're state by state, precinct by precinct. Washington State's Secretary of State Kim Wyman, a Republican, calls Trump's comments about rigging elections irresponsible. Although Wyman herself has said Washington's elections do have a security problem in that you don't have to be a citizen to get a Washington driver's license. That's unusual in this country, and she would like to change that so that the driver's license you flash at a polling place, if there were one, also shows your citizenship. Still, Wyman says about the presidential election, quote, "There will be no rigging on our watch." You're listening to The Record on KOW. Let's talk now about the other stuff Donald Trump has said. I'm sure you've heard the recording of Trump bragging about groping women, but it's not just Trump on that recording. You hear Trump being encouraged by TV host Billy Bush.
You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab him by the I can do anything.
Legs. All I can see is the legs.
No, it looks good.
Trump's wife, Melania, said in an interview yesterday that the problem wasn't what her husband said, but the way Billy Bush, quote, egged him on. So how could Bush have handled that differently? And what can the rest of us learn? Western Washington psychology professor Alex Zopp has studied this, and he says there are strategies you can use to push back against people saying something offensive.
Depending on the person and how well you know them, something slight like changing the subject and hopefully relying on that person's emotional intelligence to read this as a cue of disapproval. And you realize hopefully that, wow, the conversation suddenly shifted after I made this comment. Maybe that wasn't okay. Some people
are bad. So you're kind of giving them an out that they don't have to deal with what was just said, and yet you're also sending a message.
At least not in the moment. You're right. So maybe it gives them an out, and you can approach them privately about this. Hey, you know when we were out there before and you made this comment, I thought that was really just not in good taste. And so it saves them a little that public face, and you can address it privately if you wish. So that's one possible way. Sometimes that's not what we want to do, and sometimes we want to make it more public and address that person to make it clear, again, more publicly to others in the room and in the area that this isn't okay. And that's just one of the more subtle ways. Certainly you could find ways that may be effective that can appeal to the person's ego, allow them to feel valued in some other way by affirming them and saying something like, "Wow, you're normally such a really intelligent and well-informed person, so I'm really surprised to hear you say this." You're complimenting on the one hand, and it's not really a backhanded compliment because you mean this, but at the same time, it sort of plays on that and say, well, why would you say something like this given how much I think of you already?
That's interesting. So can that give them more leeway to change their behavior instead of resisting you?
That's the idea behind that approach, is that by sort of greasing the wheels a little bit, you're making them not so reactive to the negativity involved, because these are going to be uncomfortable situations no matter what. So if you can sort of reduce some of that awkwardness, that might be helpful. And again, it really depends on the person. Sometimes, not just the person we're confronting, but as the one making the confrontation, we don't want to be calm. We don't want to be subtle. We feel really angry, and we feel that type of emotional expression is valid. So we might confront in a more emotional way. And even still, there's other ways you can play off of your feelings. So you can invoke feelings of perhaps hypocrisy in the person by using their own words against them. So I'm really surprised to hear you say that, because I know nobody respects women more than you, for example. Sort of hearing that and saying, well, geez, how can I reconcile this feeling of hypocrisy within myself now?
What's the goal here?
Yeah, so it's interesting. In these situations, the goal pretty much is going to have to rely on a change in behavior, like you mentioned. It's pretty unlikely we're going to have any long-term effects on changing a person's attitudes, and certainly not their values. But if we can change their future behaviors, that's at least a step in the right direction. And those changes in their behaviors could happen for a number of reasons. It could be because they have these strong personal standards of, you know, this is wrong, and I felt bad for doing this, and I made a mistake. So people who even are really well-intentioned sometimes make comments, laugh at jokes, and then later realize, geez, I really shouldn't have done that. And they want to change because of their own personal interests. And so they'll change their behavior both publicly and privately in the future because of this confrontation, hopefully. Other people might not care so much about this in terms of their own personal standards, but are really aware that this isn't okay to say in public. So they might change their behavior, but only publicly and perhaps somewhat superficially, because they know that others will disapprove of this in the future. So there's likely to be some changes in behavior afterwards, and it might be, again, for more internal or external reasons, but either way, fewer racist and sexist statements out there is probably better.
You know, our society has gone along with and downplayed or even kept private a lot of unacceptable behavior. What's wrong with saying, hey, that's sexual assault or whatever the behavior is? What's wrong with you? you know, what's wrong with being direct?
I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And certainly in the moment when you have these emotional reactions that you want to address, it's obviously this is how a person feels, and that's a valid reaction. It's a kind of a cost and benefits analysis of what your goals are and what you're trying to do. So simply lashing out and expressing your own feelings and labeling this and saying, hey, that's really racist when you say that, certainly is a valid interpretation from your end. But keeping in mind that it's unlikely to have a direct effect on the other person. No one likes to be accused of racism. Even racists don't like that. So the idea that it's going to lead to any positive change is unlikely. So finding a way to kind of balance this and be true to your own feelings and not sort of say the wrong thing in those situations, but at the same time, hopefully have a way of doing it that can influence the other person some way or another.
By the way, I may sound really sanctimonious even asking you these questions, because I can a little piece of me relates to the Billy Bush, not in that situation, but I've been in places where I have gone along. I wonder why is it so hard to just sometimes stand up for what we believe?
There's basic norms of conversation and politeness that really discourage these types of things. So for the most part, even implying that someone might have said something that could be interpreted as racist or sexist tends to really be frowned upon. And I think that partly comes from a skewed interpretation of what it means to be racist or sexist, and that by calling someone's joke or their behavior as consistent with prejudice doesn't mean that someone is in fact a racist for having done a single behavior. So I think we have this reluctance to say anything because it's seen as impolite. There's also, you know, the nature of the relationship with this person that we have. This could be an employer, this could be friends, these could be relatives, and we have those underlying relationships that we have to keep in mind. And sometimes we're okay with some of those if it's a relative we don't see very often, but if it's a close friend or an employee that we see all the time, we've got to consider those relationships. And sometimes we think about what long-term effects might this have on this person. And if we think, you know, this isn't going to do anything, this person is just who they are, and no matter what I say, they're going to keep doing this. Sometimes we have this sort of self-defeating attitude going in there that thinks that I'm not going to be able to have an effect on someone. And this can be really unfortunate because the effects that we may have on someone are likely to be out of our sight. We won't see them happening because they'll be in the future when we're not around. So that sometimes holds us short when it shouldn't.
And I would hope in any cost-benefit analysis, we'd consider the cost that's being borne by the people who are being treated the way this person is describing, whoever's in the one down.
And there's a real interesting component of that. Our research has found that in many situations, it's members of groups that are not the ones targeted by the offense. So in the case of sexism, we can talk about men, or in the case of certain types of racism, we can talk about whites, that men and whites in those situations tend to be a little bit more persuasive in their confrontations because they're not seen as the ones who are overreacting. They're not seen as the typical complainers who say that everything is sexism or racism. So there's some really unique opportunities there that we can work on the behalf of those members of those groups.
That's interesting. Use that voice, fair or unfair, the voice that you might have with that fellow person in power.
That's right.
Interesting. And hey, let's not assume that we are always our best selves. What do we do when someone calls us out for something we've done or said?
That's a great point. I think we've been talking a lot about these situations from the perspective of who's been offended, the person who's been offended, and how they can confront someone else. But we should remember that there's probably been times when we've been, or certainly could have been, at the other end of someone else's confrontations because of the subtle nature of these implicit biases. And so when we're the ones that have been confronted, we can think about how, you know, we probably initially rejected the confrontation and the person who made it. And we don't like to be accused of this type of bias, especially if in the past we've been confronting other people about bias. But probably when we step back and realize this, that upon reflection that, you know, we were wrong and we shouldn't have done this. This gives us a really, I think, great opportunity to kind of come full circle and approach the person who confronted us and let them know this side of the story. Because as confronters, we don't know that side of the story. Now here's our opportunity to share it with the person. Tell them and say, you know, at first I was really upset, but it really made me rethink a few things about myself and assumptions that I've had, and I'm glad it happened. And that person gets that feedback and they feel better about what they've done, knowing that they've actually made a difference.
Both sides can really buck up here, can't they? The people who need to gather the courage to say something difficult, and the people who need to gather the courage to listen.
Absolutely. I think you can feel some strength in being the one who's confronting someone else about this. But as long as we're doing this, again, from a place of perhaps compassion and not just being this, like you said, really sanctimonious person who says, I'm holier than you and you're doing the wrong thing. But if it's really from a place of, look, this is how I feel about this issue and I value your relationship and I want to share this with you. And then from the other side of it, the person who's being confronted, don't necessarily feel like you've been accused of being the worst person in the world simply by someone saying, hey, that joke was a little off color. We can understand that we'd all make mistakes and we can learn from those. And that learning process is difficult. But if we swallow that pride a little bit and understand now this is going to make us better and we're closer as a result of this conversation.
Professor Alex Zopp teaches psychology at Western Washington University. How do you deal with this? How do you deal with offensive language? How do you handle yourself if you get accused of being offensive? Do you have a story? Because we'd like to know. We'd like you to share it when you write to us at record@kuow.org. Here with KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. Are you a short story kind of person, or more you like to lose yourself in a long novel? The writer C.S. Lewis put himself in the latter category, according to Nancy Pearl.
He once said that there's not a cup of tea big enough or a novel long enough to satisfy him. So, Laurie Ostlund's book, After the Parade. Last week we talked about difficult books to read. And I have to say that After the Parade, for me, was a difficult book to read as well. This won several awards. It's a first novel. She had brought out a collection of short stories prior to this. And I was not familiar with her. This is another book that I just picked up. I think partly because I liked the cover. I thought it was quite interesting. Some critics are calling this tragicomic, like, and comparing it to John Irving, for example, or even Elizabeth Strout. I don't think there's anything comic in this book. This is a wonderful portrait of a man, and we meet him when he's 18, and we follow him for the next decade and a half or so. A young man, and this is a man a boy who was always different from everybody else, who always felt he didn't belong, who grew up in a family that had with a father who was extremely abusive. And he, the main character in this book, is gay. He knows that he's gay early on. His father can't accept that. He's looking all of his life for a home, for a family. When the book opens, we are with him as he leaves his longtime lover and moves to San Francisco from the Midwest. And then the book goes back and shows us how he got to that point and then what his experiences in San Francisco were. It's beautiful writing. That's part of what makes it so painful to read, because she has this ability to show the reader the abuse that Aaron experienced from his father and the neglect by his mother.
Nancy, you mentioned this is a first novel by Laurie Ostlund, and that's Ostlund. But how do you find these books? Do they find you?
That's such a good question. I have to think at this point that they find me. You know, I pick it up. There's a blurb on the back from Richard Russo. And it was a book of the year from NPR. None of those necessarily would draw me to this book. And yet something said, oh, just start this book. And I did. And then I wanted to find out more about Aaron and what made him into the person that he was.
Who would you recommend this book to?
I would recommend this book to anyone who loves character-driven fiction. It has the two things that I look for in a novel: wonderful writing and three-dimensional characters. And those are the books that I am drawn to, and those are evidently the books that find themselves in my hands to read.
That book in her hands is called After the Parade, a first novel by Laurie Ostlund. And that was Nancy Pearl talking with KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman. You'll find all of Nancy's book reviews at KUOW.org. Finally, on the record, I can't believe I didn't think of Eddie. I was telling you the WikiLeaks emails from Hillary Clinton's campaign showed three Seattleites on her list of possible running mates: Bill Gates, Melinda Gates, and Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. And I asked you what other locals should be a heartbeat away from the presidency. Jennifer says that her idea actually made this year's Seattle Times list of top 10 imaginary headlines, and that was Gary Locke, early Clinton favorite for VP choice. Jennifer calls Washington's former governor a historic choice. And on Twitter, Joe reminds us of somebody who's already getting nominated this week, the newest nominee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. How about Vice President Eddie Vedder? Dream a little dream on me. Stars fading, but I linger on. Oh, craving all kills. I'm longing. What about other Seattleites? What about a Seattleite or two already in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? You could argue that if anyone should be a heartbeat away from the presidency, it is Hart. So, Ann and Nancy Wilson, start gathering your tax returns. Thank you for listening to KOW's The Record. Get the podcast of this show and the Week in Review, all our local news coverage, where you get your podcasts.